episode 64 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I am joined by Cassie Gullifer, a middle school band director out of southeastern Virginia. She and I actually went to high school together here in Florida and played and marched in band together. She and I are friends on Facebook, and her posts constantly have me in tears and or applauding her and her classroom on a regular basis, so I knew she would be a great guest on the show. Cassie and I talk about accepting your students appropriately, the damage of testing on our system and our schools, standards-based grading and band and how powerful it can be, the value of arts education, the pressures of teaching on teachers, and how teachers need to relax sometimes, and the respect that elective teachers get from their students. So, sit back and enjoy episode 64 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Cassie Gullifer. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Treffler, and I am joined today by somebody that I've genuinely waited to have on the show because I have known this person since I was in high school, quite literally, and we're Facebook friends and the whole like, and she makes some of the single greatest educational Facebook posts of all time, both hilarious and also insightful and awesome and amazing. So I'm really excited to get to introduce a friend of mine, Cassie Gullifer. How are you doing today?
Very well. What an introduction.
I try. This is the only part of the show where I really get to talk is the intro. That's like the only time I get to sort of free flow. So I like to try to put a little effort into them. Could you, Cassie, for my audience who don't know you from high school, give me an idea of who you are and what you do?
I live in southeastern Virginia. I'm a middle school band director, sixth through eighth grade. I teach beginning, intermediate, advanced band. And this year is my 11th year in the classroom. I teach at a regular school, no academies, no magnet programs. My school is in a lower middle class socioeconomic area, and we are one-to-one digital technology, just to give you an idea of my classroom environment.
Cool. And I'm not kidding when I say I've wanted to have you on the show for a while. There's like this running list in my head of people I know in the real world and also people I know online who I want to have on the show. And I intentionally put you a little farther down because I felt like I needed to be a better host and a year or so into my show before I felt like I could keep up with you as a guest on my show. Because I have had so many experiences where I'm randomly scrolling through Facebook, which I don't actually do often, and the one person I think in my timeline who can actually get me to stop and read a wall of text and hit the like show more button is you, because your stories are the funniest classroom stories I think ever written are the things that happen in your band room, and they crack me up every time.
My kids are live, I'll tell you that. I ask them 20 times a day, why are you the way you are?
Could you maybe for my audience just share one of your favorite classroom stories that comes to mind? And I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but one of your favorite classroom stories that comes to mind?
Oh.
Or maybe a recent one if you can't think of a favorite.
On Friday of last week, one of my little dudes in sixth grade, I was doing introductions of instruments. I was playing some YouTube videos and demoing myself the instruments. And I had them watching a 2009 recording of a trumpet concerto, the Haydn trumpet concerto. And the camera zoomed in on the timpani player, who was probably in his 50s, and he had white hair. And this little dude was like, old man can get it. You can keep playing for the rest of your life. And I was like, that's right. That's inspirational. I'm glad to know you think you can keep playing the rest of your life. And I'm sad to know 50 is the end. Like, I might have been 50. But that's what I, that's every day in my classroom.
Yeah. Oh, you have just, you, your kids are not afraid to speak their minds, it seems, even when they have not put any thought into what they're about to say.
It's kind of... Sometimes I wish they wouldn't. Yes, you're correct.
Some of the stories, and you have a way of writing them that just manages to capture every bit of the emotion and that moment that every teacher has on a regular basis where you just kind of face palm and just go, no, oh God, no.
You're like, baby, yet so far.
It is something. It is quite an experience. But what's interesting to me is on top of that, not only do you do a wonderful job of explaining some of the ridiculous things that happen, but I think you also do, you make it clear and do a phenomenal job of accepting your students for who they are in a lot of very reasonable ways. In fact, the last post that, that really got me to make the final say and like, okay, it's time to invite you on was a post about uniforms for your band program. And I think that you just do such a good job of sort of accepting your students for who they are, but at the same time, sort of giving them a real world sort of feel to what they're doing. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. My band wears traditional gowns and suits for performances. And I, in an effort to respect gender identity, but also the aesthetic I'm trying to present, which is one of professionalism, because even though they're little kids, they can do really great stuff. And every bit of the aesthetic decision of a band program is the choice of the director. So how they dress, how they enter and exit stages, the music we present, how we perform, all of those things are my choice. So my deal with them is that I'm not telling them what they are. I'm just telling them what they're going to wear. So if they tell me they're a dude, I give them a suit. And if they tell me they're a lady, I give them a gown. And if they tell me they're neither, I tell them to pick one, but they have to pick one. They don't get to camp up one or the other or wear the suit, but they got to wear it with skater shoes because it's really important that they have their skater identity. They have to pick one of these things and they wear one of these uniforms, but I'm not going to check their birth certificates or lecture them on how they have to fit in one box or another, because exactly none of them wear formal wear to school every day. So if they don't like it from a fashion standpoint, well, that's everybody that doesn't like it from a fashion standpoint. I don't wear what I wear to concerts to school every day. It's a formal occasion. So this is what we're wearing, but I don't push them into a corner to say, well, you have to wear this because you're a little boy and you have to wear this because you're a little girl. Cause I just don't think that that's the point of it all.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's such a great look of like, you're going to be one or the other because that's what this is. Like it's, but I'm not saying you have to be the one you are. It's such a good combo of sort of accepting, but also this is presenting yourself in a specific way. And I'm asking you to present yourself in this way. And I imagine your students respond well to a moment like that.
They tend to, because usually it starts off, because they are pretty young, and well, I think they're plenty old enough to know their gender identity. I do not think that there's a low end age cap on that. Sixth graders know whether they think they're male or female or not. Maybe they're not comfortable enough to say it out loud if it bucks the social norms, but they know. But they don't necessarily have the maturity to know time and place and discretion for how they should dress. And so I compare it more like, it's not that I'm telling you that you're male or female. It's that when you go to a funeral, you dress a certain way. When you go to a wedding, you dress a certain way. When you go to the beach, you dress a certain way. You look really ridiculous in a suit at the beach, just like you'd look really ridiculous in a bathing suit at a funeral. And it's about decorum. And that's what we're doing here, is there's a certain amount of decorum. And that's gender neutral. And bands just don't have the budget to suit every fashion preference. And I could probably rant for 25 minutes about how pants are not gender neutral. And so when people say, well, why don't you just put the whole band in pants? I'm a tomboy who would have rather put 28 needles in my eye than worn ill-fitting dress pants that were hoisted somewhere south of my nipples at every performance. Like, I would have pulled my hair out having to do that. And to get pants that fit every different shaped girl in your band is a nightmare. And so pants are not gender neutral. Pants are men's dress clothes that we wear because it's the privilege of womanhood to get to do that, I guess. I don't know. It's sexist and I could like scream about it. So having gowns is actual, like, having clothes that fit them is how you respect their gender identities. And then letting them pick which one they are is the second step of that. And then now some, every so often I run into a parent that doesn't support their kid's gender identity. And then that's where I get between a rock and a hard place between mom or dad and a kid, because I don't actually get to make those decisions about the kid's life. So even if I respect the gender identity, if their parents don't, then I'm sort of in a bad spot. But that I take on a case by case basis.
Yeah, it's good. I really appreciate that as someone who, you know, is also in the school system and can deal with some of these issues. And now I'm in middle school and I'm starting to realize that, you know, I don't know. I think having not been in middle school for a long time and being at high school, I had sort of incorrectly assumed that middle schoolers don't know what's going on. Like, they don't necessarily know their own gender identity, but yes, certainly now I can say they do. Like, I can see that with the kids. And I just think it's great that you're accepting of that and yet also accepting of the realities and limitations of what you can actually do. So I just think it's a good, I'm good. I'm glad. I'm happy. I, if my son ends up in a band program, I would hope that his teacher would be as acceptable as you.
Aww,
and that his band director is as awesome as you. So I'm excited for that. I'm glad. I appreciate that a lot. And I just want you to know that people notice it. It's out there and it's appreciated. And I think rare. I think it's rare to have that level of, sort of open-mindedness. I feel like in band programs sometimes, because at least where I am, I feel like sometimes the band programs can be very old school male dominated. And so I think it's good. I'm glad. I'm happy about it.
I am acutely aware of that aspect of band directing. Because my kids wear what I tell them to wear, but I wear gowns on stage because I don't wear pants. Almost ever. They're ill-fitting. And why would I go on stage with my rear end facing the audience and something I'd never even wear to school? And so I get pushed back on that myself simply because I just don't look like my colleagues when I'm on stage. And my own students respond pretty positively to it because there's a certain level of grandeur you bring to it when I'm not even dressed like I dress every day. Like, I come out there like it's the biggest thing that I've ever done, because it's the biggest thing that they've ever done to date. And so I'm trying to treat it the way that it, with the level of importance it is to their 11, 12, 13 year old life. And so we pull out all the stops for the performance.
I think that's appropriate. I like it. Good stuff. Already on a good start. I'm excited. It's going to be good. It's going to be great. We're going to get some more stories out of you. We're going to get some more good stuff. And we're going to do that through the lens of my three questions. And my first question for all of my guests is a doozy. It's a big one. But my first question for all of my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Oh, that's actually a really easy question.
Oh, wow. I've never had anybody say that before.
We've lost our minds with testing.
Okay.
Like, it completely changes the way we interact in the back quarter of the school year. My own school shuts down during testing. We have altered schedules. They're in boot camps for testing prep. I have class, but I never know who's going to be in my class. So I schedule my concerts to end before state testing starts. And then I do music history, solo and ensemble, things that if many kids are missing, it wouldn't, you know, destroy rehearsal, because you can't have rehearsal with 10 or 15 kids missing, not effectively anyway. And I watch my students turn into stressful balls of emotion, and they're young and they don't all have coping skills. So they tend to spill out in other ways. So there's lots of disciplinary problems that we don't have the rest of the year. Kids acting very uncharacteristically. I have more students that have anxiety and depression on 504 plans than I've ever had in the past, in the last couple of years, because the, not just the importance of the testing, but the way the entire environment in the school changes during testing. Because I've taught at schools where we just treat testing like another day and it doesn't seem to affect the students. But in schools that are marginal in any way, where they're at risk of losing accreditation, where they're at risk of not meeting AYP, which is where I am now, it is a complete culture change in the building during the month and a half of testing. That I had hives through all of testing last year, and I don't even teach a subject that tests because the building is so stressful that it just, like, all of us boil over with it. And so you're trying to be a calming place and you're trying to have low stress interactions and low stress learning activities for your students during it because no one else is. and so you're not trying to pile on. So basically you have to almost stop teaching new material during this time because they don't have the brain space to be able to handle anything that they don't already know, because the rest of their day is so ratcheted up. And I despise the last 8 or 9 weeks of school every year, and those are those last few weeks that I should be relishing the last sounds I'm making with my oldest kids and getting them ready to send them off to high school and ready to, you know, just hit the ground running with this new awesome stage of their life. And my older kids are acting like absolute yahoos. Like, by the time they walk out the door, I am ready to kick them in the butt on the way out. Like, they are just acting like absolute just jackals in the last weeks of school. And I know that it is just a matter of emotional maturity, that they don't have a way to process all of that stress. So it just comes out in these ways. And yeah, testing, I think it lost its level, its point about 5, 7, 8 years ago. And we've gone into the, like, uncanny valley with it, where we're now saying that it is the only metric by which we can judge students, teachers, the content of character. Like, you'd think that if you don't have increased testing scores every single quarter for the rest of time, that you're a failure as a teacher. But children are not investments. They are the product. Like, and products are developed and they go through beta testing, and sometimes you have to put patches out, and sometimes there are bugs, and, like, they are not just something that continuously appreciates in value. Like, you can't treat them like that, because they're unpredictable. And by not treating them like individual people and treating them like test scores, you are both going to do a lower quality job of educating them. And no one is going to enjoy learning, which has lifelong implications.
There's a easy answer, but a lot to unpack in there.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely a humongous problem with the testing system the way it is. There's a huge issue with where we're at right now and the level of testing, the amount of testing. At least I can say in the US, I can pretty safely say the entire country is pretty much at that point right now. And yet I can't speak for you, but I know when I went to school, the test was a joke, right? Like, one day a year, you did a bunch of standardized tests for like one day and it sucked, but it was kind of like, all right, that's done. Let's move on.
Yeah, if it was like that, it would probably be pretty tolerable, but it is definitely not that way. Not where I am at all anymore.
No, it's definitely not. And I guess what's the solution? Because realistically, there could be, I don't think there necessarily is in the way we're doing it now, but there could be some validity to having standardized tests, because I could have a whole different argument about the validity of grading on the whole and how grades are subjective and usually based more on behavior than they are learning. And so there can be validity to a standardized metric that is equivalent and coldly calculated statistics across the board, to be able to say if a student is learning and what they might need support with. And I can see the value of having the data in order to make informed decisions about what a student needs. But I think I agree we're not going about it the way we need to. So where would we find that balance in your eyes, or how do we get to that balance maybe?
I think that we have, I think we've gotten, as a culture, lost in data. I think there's a point at which it stops giving you actionable information and it just gives you information to take action on. And what I mean by that is the busy bee work of data collection can make you feel like you're getting to know your students better when you could probably do half as much data collection and replace that with, I don't know, talking to them. That might help. That you, but we are so pressed with things that we are district mandated to do to collect that data, that sometimes it takes us longer to get to know our own students, which is far more effective at educating them individually than having all of these data points. I mean, you can't even go buy gelato without someone asking you to take a survey about your experience. Like, we've lost our mind with how you don't need data on my gelato experience. And every part of our culture wants data on something. We're collecting so much information and it can't possibly all be useful. And I think that with testing, I know that I graduated high school in 2003, for the sake of your listeners. And we took one day of tests that were loosely comprehensive. And there was, you know, I'm sure, a handful of questions from everything we learned over time. My students, each grade level takes a multi-hour exam in every subject they're taking. So on any given day of the SOL window, there is some grade level testing somewhere in the building on some subject. So for almost four consecutive weeks where we have exams happening in the building, which if you're not testing, the building's shut down during that time. So there's no activities, there's silence in the hallways. There's just no way for students to decompress, even if they're not the ones testing. And I cannot be convinced that you need to have a 90 or 100 question exam on every subject a kid is taking when they are 11. What were we doing for hundreds of years before this? And, and when the same people that are the CEOs of these testing companies, which are companies and they are not educational, they are the same people who lament where education has gone. So either somehow you got a good education when no one was data mining you from before you knew your blood type, or this isn't necessary. They can't be both. Yeah. If education was better once upon a time, there's a notable difference. We talk about how kids don't have critical thinking. Well, you take 4 weeks of the school year and you make it testing. You've shortened the school year by 4 weeks and there is more to teach. Not to even sound stupid, but as time marches on, history courses get longer. History courses are longer. We want to teach all these 21st century skills, but by God, the downfall of society is the fact that kids can't write in cursive anymore and they can't read analog clocks. And something has to go. And I don't think it necessarily needs to be analog clocks and cursive. I think it needs to be testing. I think we have plenty of time to teach deeply and meaningfully if you gave me all 9 months of the school year. But you don't. You give me 9 months minus 5 weeks. because
the 5 weeks, I think the 5 weeks doesn't even begin to count the true damage that's being done there. I mean, 5 weeks is the directly applicable. Those are the 5 weeks that it's most obvious, but how much of that time is kind of like you said in triage support classes and how many kids are losing another elective because they need a remedial math or remedial reading class because they're not passing the reading, the state reading or math exam. And so they lose an elective for it. And that loses an entire year of learning in some other course to reteach something that could have been taught naturally and deeply in their existing English class or math class. And, you know, so I think I agree. I agree with you there that the 5 weeks is damaging, but it also probably is just the tip of the iceberg in a lot of places. And in a lot of places, they try to say that I know in the state of Florida, for example, they were trying to pass a bill where the testing all had to be done within a certain time frame, or it limited the number of tests each student could take. And we said, okay, well, if you limit the number of students each student can take, you really haven't done anything, because every kid has to take four and they take them on four different days of everybody else. And then you still are taking up 4 weeks. It's just spread out differently than it was before.
Yeah.
It's not a solution.
No, it is a culture problem in our school too, that now students are worried more about their testing scores than they are about the actual learning. And seeing that shift in my students was what motivated me to move to standards-based grading about 6 years ago, because I found my kids so focused on numbers and not content or quality that I had to flip the script. I had to eliminate the metric that they understood and that they had associated their self-worth with. And I had to move to something else. I would have graded them using American cars if I thought that that would have sufficiently like eliminated the association between like good kid, good grade, bad grade, because they have focused so much on these numbers. And instead of being able to view learning as a non-linear progression, because sometimes you take a step back to make a leap forward. And I'm in a long game. I teach the same kids for 3 years. So if you can't get it right now, well, I don't just have till the end of the semester. I have until the end of middle school. And we got this. And that relaxed kind of environment gets you so much more results. But with the continuous time restraints of pacing guides and state mandated testing windows breathing down the necks of teachers and then consequently students, it's oppressive. And I don't even teach a subject that takes a state test. And that's the thing that blows my mind, is that I don't even teach that subject, any of those subjects, and I feel the pressure of that system. So if I was one of those subjects, I think I'd already be a paralegal or an x-ray tech or a phlebotomist. You know, they got those commercials, 18 months and you can be certified. I would have done that so long ago. It would have been over.
And you hit on a good point, though, is that it becomes oppressive for the teachers. And then the teachers feeling oppressed, the kids feel that the teachers are feeling oppressed or are feeling this pressure, and that makes them feel more pressure, which then makes them do worse on the test because of the stress of it. And we create this sort of sick cycle of just spiraling downward into this negative space. And I can see that for sure. You said something, not to change the topic, but you said something in there that I'm interested in. And you're doing standard-based grading in a band course?
I am, and I love it.
That is, I would call, unusual, or at least uncommon.
I could sing it.
Can you give me an idea of what that's like? Please do. I'd love to hear.
It has freed me from trying to quantify aesthetics. So for your listeners that may not be familiar with this, standard-based grading is a pointed metric scale that is not out of 100. So I use a 4-point scale, and 4 is advanced proficient, 3 is proficient, 2 is developing proficiency, 1 is novice, and 0 is did not attempt. And that allows me to say that, yeah, you know, if you played all the notes and rhythms, then you're proficient, but you didn't really make music. And before, the kids had a really hard time understanding that when they played all the notes and rhythms right, but they didn't get a 100 because they needed the 100 because good kids get good grades. They needed 100. they had a hard time focusing on that. And even though what's around the music is what makes it musical, articulations, dynamics, expression, tone quality, just those things that make it, personal. And those are what make them make music. And in this metric, it's really easy for them to understand that that's an advanced proficiency. So I didn't tell you you weren't proficient. I told you that you just didn't level up. And then they understand that idea because 3 means I did my job. 4 means I'm doing the most work. And 2 means I'm almost there. And they view that as a much more, because it, since it's newer to them, it doesn't have the same meaning as like A, B, C, D, E. And also, and this is important to me, is it, their parents don't understand what it means. And I know that sounds like a really awkward way to phrase a positive, but that means that I get to frame what grades mean to my parents too. Because parents will focus like, why didn't Sally get 100? I heard her play her flute solo perfectly in the living room before dinner. And it's like, well, yeah, if it's one dynamic level the entire time, it wasn't perfect. It wasn't imperfect. And that learning that took a skill, and I want to acknowledge and respect and honor the effort and time and skill that it took to do what they did, but then let them know that we're not done. You're not going to be done. I haven't stopped learning to play my instrument better, and you're not going to today in the 7th grade. And so being able to reframe grading for my parents also has really eliminated any kind of discussions had over who gets solos, who gets this, who gets that. Parents that get their hairs raised up over their perception of what grades should be or their perception of how music should be. Because if you went to school before 10 or 15 years ago, you probably didn't do anything in your band class except for scale tests and play concerts. And now we expect kids to read and write and talk about music and be able to be complete musicians. And that includes expressive musicians. And we're asking them to express emotional range of their music that they may not even possess in their life yet. And that's a developing, nonlinear academic track. And the standards-based grading lets me honor their accomplishments without the negative connotation of a less than perfect grade. And I also don't have to explain the difference between a 96 and a 97 on a playing test because I can't. Can anybody? Like, can anybody tell me what the difference? If you're saying yes, you're lying. You can't tell me the difference between a 96 and a 97 on a playing test, especially when it's something out of the Red Book. God love Bruce Pearson and his friends, but that music's not inspirational. And you can't tell me the difference between a 96 and a 97. So by having that, then the kids know 3 means I'm on the right track, 4 means I'm balling. And that's how we describe that stuff. So it's been, I started doing it probably, I want to say it was the 2012 school year is when I started doing standards-based grading. And at first, it was a huge adjustment for my students and their parents. And our elementary schools had just shifted to a similar system. So the parent, the school community wasn't really ready for it yet. And only some of the middle school teachers were doing it. Like, we have the option in middle school to have a standards-based grade book or a regular grade book. And I know that I'm one of the only a handful of their teachers that ever do. So a lot of my parents have questions, but since now we're quite a few years into the elementary schools doing it, they understand it a little better when they come to me than they did a few years ago.
Well, and like you said, you loop. So you explain it to your 6th grade kids, but then it's, you're not explaining it to,
correct.
You're not explaining it to 7 classes worth of kids every year.
Correct. Yeah. And I couple that with, unlimited late work, which again is one of those things that I could rant on for 100 years, but I support it wholeheartedly, is I take unlimited late work until the end of a grading period. So I mean, there has to be a deadline because a grade has to go in the book eventually, right? But they are not yet responsible. We're teaching them responsibility and teaching them to follow through is a major tenet of being responsible. And so if you have to, no matter what, still get that work turned in, and you can't just take the L, as my kids like to say, you can't just take that L, then that's teaching responsibility. And I mean, even my mortgage company gives me a few days of grace period. And so I don't know why teachers act like that theory assignment can't get taken on Thursday when you said it was due on Wednesday. That's just not true. And we all know we didn't grade it on Wednesday. We know it. We didn't.
Well, and not only that, we don't turn our lesson plans in on Monday every week either. I mean, we're not perfect about that.
Correct.
Either.
Yeah. And so if I know I miss deadlines sometimes, and I'm a pretty organized person, but I still miss deadlines, then how can I expect an 11-year-old? Like, this is where they're learning to be responsible. They are not yet fully formed people. I mean, the shenanigans in my classroom should let me know that every day that they're not yet fully formed. the only thing that seems fully formed on them is their sweat glands because they smell terrible. That's it. So I couple the standards-based grading with the revolving deadlines, and I feel like it creates a compassionate classroom culture. For my kids, it respects them to, it gives them the respect to know that I know my class is not their only class, and they may have other demands between other classes, their family, their extracurriculars, and that they still have to meet their responsibilities, but that I can be flexible if they come to me and let me know they need a minute for something. And that's just one of the many ways that I respect their personhood in my classroom.
Well, and I think going back to, you know, seeing your Facebook posts and everything else, if you go back to the level of comfort your students clearly have with you, or at least maybe not comfort, but respect or understanding that you're the person that is, while maybe we'll come up with a sarcastic retort, is going to at least let them speak their mind. And I think that it's being reflected in your grading and measuring practices through your standards-based grading. And I think you know, accepting late work to me, I agree with you, lines up perfectly with standard based, because if all I'm looking to track is that they've learned it, it doesn't matter if they learned it when I expected them to. I care that they learned
it. Oh, yes.
You know, that's what matters.
And I don't grade behavior. So because there's a thousand other ways to discipline a child than a bad grade. And by giving kids a bad grade because of bad behavior, all you're doing is shooting in the foot any kind of developing love of learning, which goes back to that whole lifetime implications thing. I think about everything we do as middle school teachers as what sets them up either to springboard them into success or to tie a boulder around their ankle and sink them to the bottom of the ocean. Because this is right about where school gets real, is in middle school, where they start having to learn conceptual concepts. So it's not quite as tangible as many elementary school things are, where if you can count these apples, if you can do, you know, this, that, or the other, then, and you can lay your hands on it and it's real. And now we're starting to talk about math, where they start using letters and like things start getting a little more conceptual. And this is where either students start to love learning or they hate it. And it's on us to create classroom environments that teach them that learning is progressive and not, it doesn't just get sprinkled upon you. And that's just one of the many cogs in the wheel that turn that along to make sure that when they head out the door into high school, that they're critical thinkers that can manage multiple responsibilities and they don't act like jerks. Like, those are like the three things I hope they can do. And then if they play their instruments too, that's really cool.
Fair enough. I like it. It's funny that we would end up talking about standards based and talk about grading. Cause I, a couple weeks ago, at least as the listeners are listening to this, I had Jonathan Spike on and we were talking about grading, and it got a lengthy email reply from my father, who is one of only 12 people that listen to this podcast weekly. And, he gave me a lengthy reply about how I don't, I underestimate the power grades can have in a classroom. And I said, no, I think we all overestimate the power grades can have, or at the very least ascribe way too many variables to a grade to even begin to say what part of it is or is not working.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of mentioned it, we wrap in behavior and everything else. So I think, you know, I'm right in line with you there. I'm right there with you. I think that what you're doing with standards-based grading is excellent. I think if we could just take the word grading out of it, it'd be standards-based measurement, assessment, something. I don't really like either of those words better, but you know, I think that what you're doing is right in line with where you want to be, and I think that's great. I think to be, you're a very progressive band director. I think that's across the board what I'm going to say. I'm not so naive or close-minded. Obviously, you know, I grew up in band programs, and I'm well aware of the kind of learning that happens there. But I think a lot of people look at band as like, oh, that's just that fun thing they do, and nothing real happens in there. And I think that you're clearly showing that that is not always the case.
I'm always interested to know how people that weren't in music come to that conclusion, because obviously I did something with it. Like I can't speak with the whole world, but every school has a couple of music teachers who are in the building right there looking at them face to face as a peer and a colleague and a professional. Because when I was 11, somebody gave me a trombone. And I got my start in a band room like that. And then that's what paid for my college education. And that's what put me right where I am right now. And is that going to be every one of my kids? No, but a great number of them could get music scholarships. How many people did we grow up with that are not music professionals today that paid for in full or part their education because they learned to play an instrument in school? And
yeah, I definitely did.
Yeah. And it's like, why, just because you didn't doesn't mean all the rest of us can't. I can't tell you anything about the Great Gatsby, but we all just keep on reading this book. So it must be, it must be great. They make movies about it, and it's an excuse to drink while wearing flapper clothes. So, I mean, obviously it's got staying power. So I don't know why we can't ascribe value to something just because we didn't experience it. And I find that sometimes there's a lack of professional reciprocity in our field with electives and arts teachers, as if like we're just what exists so that they can have common planning. And I have plenty to say on that one. I was like, I'm a standalone subject. Art is for the sake of art. Art is not to improve your test scores. Art is not because it improves your whatever. It's because it improves your life. It improves your ability to have empathy. It improves your interconnectedness. It improves your social skills. It teaches you in a very easy to understand at a young age way that success is incremental steps in the direction you're trying to head. And those are all life skills. And they teach it in a much more tangible way at the age of 11 than English or math can. And art for the sake of art is worth advocating for. So I gave up quite a few years ago justifying anything I do through the lens of interdisciplinary value or the value to test scores or the value to college admissions. Art is valuable, period. And that's my advocacy soapbox.
Yeah, just that's a mic drop. Art is valuable, period. That's gonna be my closeout moment on this episode, I'm telling you. Wow, cool. I love it. We're all over the place and it's great. It's good stuff. All right. I've got another question for you. Because I feel like if I don't ask this question, we'll just go off on another tangent. It's fine, but I'm gonna ask it anyways. So my second question for all my guests is, and you might have actually already touched on it, but what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Yeah, this one actually has nothing to do with kids. I find that the pressures of teaching are largely universal, no matter what your content area is. And I think that because the nature of our job is that we spend 95% of our day with children, and we don't often check in or have a decent pulse on the rest of the building, that sometimes we seem to believe that we are suffering in isolation and don't always provide any kind of graciousness or breathing space to our colleagues. because we think that they're having it easier than us. And if I wish in other classrooms, teachers would just take a step back and realize that as stressful as whatever it is to them, it's just as stressful to the other teachers. And all of that negative juju is hitting our kids in every one of the classes they attend. And so maybe we should all just chill. We should all just chill. Like maybe have like group yoga. I don't know if we need like a mimosa bar in the teacher's lounge. I don't know what the right answer is for that, but we can go weeks and never speak to each other because of this, like the way that the school is scheduled. The nature of my class is that I'm on the other side of the building. They put band rooms far away because we're noisy. And I don't have windows on my side of the building. So I refer to the other teachers as day walkers because they have windows. And I can go whole entire days and never see other teachers that aren't the chorus and orchestra teacher at my, that we share a hallway. And that means that I can disconnect from them very easily. And when you disconnect from other people, you lose a sense of collective purpose, and our students travel between us every day. And so our collective purpose needs to stay vitalized in the way that our kids are what is in common between us. And this is one of those, put your own oxygen mask on first. Like if the teachers in the building are happier, more professionally respected, less stressed, the students are better cared for and educated. And we should approach that from that angle when it comes to the finer points of juggling the thousand things that schools aren't expressly responsible for, but are affected by in terms of students' social and emotional well-being. And then they come to school where maybe some of us aren't always in the best emotional, social, mental state because of the stress and rigor of our jobs and the environments of teaching in America. So take care of teachers so we can take care of each other so that we can better take care of kids.
Yeah, I like it. I'm on board for taking care of teachers. What do you have some concrete things that either you do or wish would happen or have seen happen that can accomplish that? I mean, besides mimosa bars, I'm also on board for those. I think that's a good plan. I'm going to work on that in my school, but I don't think it's going to work.
I don't think that one's going to go well. I would say that a big change we've seen in our school is that we have this program now where if we suspect issues with a student, it doesn't have to be referred like through a disciplinary fashion. We can refer it through guidance instead. And then they kind of go on a fact-finding mission and they send out information gathering requests to teachers. And so it lets us sort of pool our collective knowledge of students. And I had a teacher just this morning come and talk to me about a kid who is nothing but golden in my class, who is having a whole lot of problems in hers. And we're only in the third week of school. And I was able to give her some insight to that student because I've had her for, this is my third year with her and this is her third week with her. And give her some insight to be a better teacher of that student. And what I liked about that interaction was that teacher wasn't married to her approach being the right one. She was married to approaching the student in the right way. And I thought that was really wonderful. And she made a fan out of me. And she's a teacher that I've worked with for several years, but I never really have any contact with because she's a grade level teacher on the other side of the building. So I never had any feelings about her positively or negatively. And today pushed her firmly into the positive column because I thought that was really wonderful because her approach was just like, this is what I do in my classroom and it's obviously not working for this student. What kind of tips can you give me? Because you've had her for years. And I was like, well, I could give you a few. Let's see if they work. And I'm sure we'll have more follow-up conversations. But I thought that was really great that her focus was on doing it right, not doing it her way.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great. I think it sounds like what we really need to do is just have more conversations with each other. You know, I mean, your story of being on the other side of the school and separated from the rest of the school, I think that's true sometimes from the people in your own hall. It is so easy to close the door and focus on. And I think the other thing you said at the beginning was this question was, we spend 95% of our day around kids. That's not healthy. Like, there's no part of dealing with an amateur child's psyche 95% of your day that is healthy. Like, you really need to talk to adults sometimes. And it is so easy to not do that. And I don't know about you, but like, when I get home, no one in my real life wants to hear anything about middle school kids. Like, they don't really care unless it's funny. Like, they don't really care about the struggles I'm dealing with because Timmy's dad and mom are getting divorced and he's become an emotional, hormonal wreck of a human being. And I actually care about this child. And he's like one of the only people I talk to consistently every day of my life. And oh my God, I'm a freak. And like, no one wants to hear that stuff. And so I think, you know, maybe we teachers need to talk to each other a little more sometimes. I think that's that's where I'm taking it on that one.
And they mix that almost good idea with our deranged data crazed life, and then they say meet together and collect common data, and it's like, no, can we just like every so often talk? That's it. That's we don't it doesn't have to get documented. And one of our programs this year is a great idea in theory, but then when there is a problem with a kid and we are trying to help it, they want you to document everything you've done to improve the relationship. And so you're like, do I quantify every fist bump, every high five? How do I do that? Because there are so many invisible things you do to have good relationships with your kids, right? And you don't really even think about them because it's just being a teacher, right? And it's kind of, it's the same way in which good classroom management is invisible. You know, you're like, how did that teacher do that? That kid is just doing what they asked him to do the first time. Like, is she a witch? Like, you want to ask these questions. And so sometimes we say, oh, let's talk about it. Let's collect, share experiences. And then we find some way to ruin that by saying, log it into this glitchy online server and fill out this paper in triplicate and make sure you send one to six different offices through interoffice mail. And you're like, oh man, you were so close to getting it right. So close. Then you went out to left field somewhere along the way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think we can tie all that together nicely. Well done. Well done. You should start your own podcast. You got this down. I've got one more for you. I got one more, and I'm excited to ask you that. I'm excited to ask you this one. My last question for all my guests is, who is the best teacher you have ever had?
I think they'd have to go into a couple different categories. And I think the fact that I even, if you'd asked me that as a kid, I probably would have had to break it down then too, is a major part of the reason why I think they were good teachers, is that they got done with me the job they meant to get done. So teachers that said, I'm going to teach you this and I'm going to make sure you can do this. And their focus as they knew what their purpose was in that classroom, and they made sure I knew and that we were going to get there together. And I'd say my three best teachers that I had in school were my ninth grade English teacher. Her name was Carla Martin. And she was the first teacher I had that, engaged me where I was and brought the content to me, which is something that we just kind of do now. Like, that's the thing. That's the new cool thing. It's like, make it interesting to kids, when school used to just be, you go to school because I'm gonna beat you if you don't get good grades. You know, like I don't think anyone cared when I was a kid about making it interesting to me. I was just expected to do it, right? and if I found it interesting, well, that was lucky. But Miss Martin made me learn to like to write, and she made me learn to like to analyze literature, and she did it by letting me do it reading Star Trek. And I didn't want to read Watership Down, and I didn't want to read because I didn't like to read, but because I had to put down my Star Trek book to read the book that they wanted me to read, and I didn't want to do that. And from a personal standpoint, she's the first teacher I ever had that looked like me, and representation matters most the day you realize you've never had it. And I remember walking into a classroom for the first time, seeing someone who looked like me doing a job I could see myself doing. And that had never happened before. So that was really cool. And even in that moment, meaningful to me. Like, I knew exactly how important it was at 14. Because I never realized I'd never had a teacher that looked like me until all of a sudden I did. And I was like, wow, I've never had a female teacher that wasn't white in my whole life. I didn't realize that until I was in the ninth grade, and all of a sudden I had a teacher that looked like me. So, I still keep in contact with her. I've messaged her a couple times. I would say in the 11 years I've been teaching, I've probably sent her 15 or 20 emails. So about once a year, I still contact her because she made that much of an impact on me. And I think of her often when I'm trying to figure out what new stupid thing kids like, to try to figure out how to teach music with it. Like when flossing became a thing, that's how I taught hemiolas, because that's 3/2. I was like, great, I got to learn how to floss, but they're going to learn what a hemiola is. My other two teachers were our band directors, Smyzik and Boyd. I would say, because they made me love music, but also love the process. And separately, I think Mr. Boyd taught me more about process, and Dr. Smyzik taught me more about the expression, passionate playing, performance. And between the two of them, are what I try to model that part of my program after. As Mr. Boyd was very methodical in the way he taught us to read, count, and to be more precise, because precise performance is the bedrock of passionate performance. And that was his approach to it. And Smyzik took it from the other direction. And between the two of them, I feel like I got a really good music education. And we played a lot of music that at the time I don't think I realized was as good as it was. I don't think I realized how much good literature we played in high school, how much exposure to masterworks of wind band literature I got to play as a high school student. Cause that was just what you did. Like, your high school is just whatever you think normal is. And now that I'm a band director, I know I got a extraordinary high school music experience. And that's them. That's because of them. And as a band director now, that obviously paid off. I did something with that, you know?
Yeah. The one of the weirdest experiences of my career lasted for 3-4 years. And it was being a colleague of Mr. Boyd. Because the school I was at previously, he was the band director and I was the digital coach. And it was the oddest experience of my life to be like, I would never call him by his first name. It's never a thing. Like, he's always Mr. Boyd. Like, I would never even just call him Boyd. He was always Mr. Boyd. Like, even in staff meetings and when I was running PD, I would still tell him, like, Mr. Boyd, would you please? Like, can I please? Like, it's one of the oddest experiences of my life. Because there's something about especially by the time you get to high school and marching band, and there's something about that respect that I don't think is the same as it is in other places. In terms of like I had phenomenal English and teachers and other teachers as well, but I don't think it's quite the same level of deference that you have in a marching band or a band scenario? I don't know. Maybe you don't.
We have them for years too. So yeah, your English teacher has your respect largely because they're a teacher and you should. And so unless they actively lose it, they have it. But I think the teachers you have for multiple years, coaches, art teachers, electives teachers, because all of us teach the same kids for multiple years, largely. And we don't just have their respect. We have their dedication and devotion, because as many tangible ways as a 12-year-old can sacrifice, they do to be in our classes. Because if they're in band for 3 years, that means they never got to bake cookies, build rockets, do all those other cool things their classmates were doing in the other electives. They never took, keyboarding. They never took computer solutions or career skills, and you know, all those other electives that are on the wheel that everyone else takes, and they get mm-hmm. to go on those little trips and do those activities, and they never do those things. And that's a sacrifice for an 11-year-old. and so obviously they're putting their money where their mouth is, that they want to be in your class, and they're buying what you're selling, right? So you do the same for them, and that kind of reciprocal respect, because I think it is certainly there. Like, I have a lot of respect for my kids because they post up a lot, because as a band student in school, you know that when it rains, it pours. So it'd be like you have regular band, and then all of a sudden you have like 5 straight days of rehearsals and performances, and you'll look at them looking exhausted, and you can't really be that tired because they've been in every minute of rehearsal that you've been in. So mm-hmm. it's like, we're suffering together. Okay, great. Misery loves company. And then at the end of it all, it's also worth it. And you have those great experiences that go along with the lifelong learning part of it that comes with it. But I couldn't imagine being a colleague with any of my previous band directors. That I think that would just bend my brain inside out, because I was an idiot in high school, you know, like weren't we all?
I remember.
And I want to be like, I promise I'm not that stupid anymore. I may still wear really ridiculous headbands, but I promise I can spell, and I went all the way in school. Like, I have a master's now. I'm not dumb.
Wow. Well, I love that. That was a great response. I love the idea of the elective teachers, and also how you talked about, you know, the teachers just generally knowing what their role was, what their goal was with you, and then accomplishing that. I think that's such a reflective way to look at how those teachers impacted you. I think that's really cool. And obviously the representation, you know, is not something that I've ever had to deal with. So I've heard it talked about, but it's not something I've had to deal with in my experience. So I appreciate that as well. I thought that was a good thing to share. So across the board, I've loved this conversation, Cassie. Thank you so much for talking with me. I really do appreciate it. It's been a great conversation. I think we could probably record for another hour and come up with plenty more to talk about.
Probably.
So we'll come up with another topic and have you back on another time, I'm sure.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you for having me. And I didn't even realize you had a podcast, and I went to listen. And so you have 13 people who listen to you regularly now, because
nailed it. Awesome. 13.
I'm a fan now. Yes. And yes, I love this. Thank you.
Cool. Absolutely. If my audience would like to reach out to you, is there a way you are reachable for them?
Absolutely. Email, I suppose. I have an Instagram, but I only use it to follow jujitsu and puppies, because you have to have a happy place. So
fair.
Email would probably be best. It's Cassie, K-A-S-S-I, Nicole, N-I-C-O-L-E, @gmail.com.
Okay. I will add that to the show notes. So if anybody mm-hmm. has questions for Cassie or just wants to know how to be an amazing band director like her, you can shoot her an email and she'll be glad to answer all of your questions. And I'm sure share some of her wonderful band stories with you, because they're hilarious and really worth the email alone. Cassie, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I really, really do. And have a great night.
You too. Bye.
Cassie, thank you so much for joining me on the show. It was great to catch up over our shared interests after all these years. To connect with Cassie, like she says in the episode, you can shoot her an email. It's at CassieNicole@gmail.com, and that is available in the show notes. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or on Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you there. And if you'd like to be a guest on the show, I'd like to hear from you as well. Please message me and let me know. You can also check out the feedback page on my website, which gives you some additional options to contact me, which is at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, remember that art is valuable. Period. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the Voice Ed Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. Voice Ed Radio. Your voice is right here.